Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We've talked about resilience before on this show, specifically about resilience in individuals. But what about what makes for resilient communities? Well, a decade ago, Daniel Aldrich got a profound lesson in how communities recover. He just moved from Brighton to New Orleans, and then Hurricane Katrina struck, putting the city underwater. It was an event that changed Aldrich's life. Daniel Aldrich is now co-director of the Center for Resilience Studies at Northeastern University, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us what happened. I mean, you'd only been in New Orleans for what, a month or two?
About 6 weeks. And there were six really good weeks. We had a banana tree in the backyard, a kid's pool, really green grass, really nice neighbors. And we had no idea what it meant to go through a hurricane. The 6 weeks we were there, beautiful weather, absolutely gorgeous, some rain. And then that end of August, I think the 27th, 28th, we keep the Sabbath, the Shabbat. And over that weekend, we noticed our neighbors were packing up. A lot of them were putting their dogs in the back of their pickup trucks, getting grandma with them to go out of the town. And we were asking ourselves, what's going on? We didn't hear the radio or the TV news. And then after the Sabbath ended, Saturday night, around 10:30 or so, one of our guests said he'd been recalled back to the military base in Mississippi. There's a big storm coming, and we should think about leaving. Now, we had no idea what he meant. Leave to go where? We didn't have any idea what to do. And then about an hour later, one of our neighbors knocked on our door. Her name was Kathy. And Kathy said, you got two young kids, right? We said, sure. She said, you should really leave pretty soon. This will be a bad one.
So you're hearing from your neighbors, not necessarily from government officials or emergency managers.
Exactly. And that was Kathy's warning to us. And we took that seriously because she'd been there a long time. She knew who we were. She knew it of our kids. So we began calling Houston to find a hotel room. All the roads in New Orleans we knew would go west, all of I-10. So we finally find a hotel room around 2 o'clock in the morning, the last hotel room, we think, in some park on the edge of Houston. And we made a reservation. We put one of our cars on higher ground. We thought it was higher ground, which is the median strip in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And my wife was very smart. She packed the car with one bag for the kids, toys to play with, books to read, and some clothes for 2 or 3 days. We left everything else, so musical instruments, computers, yeah, files, our other car in the house, of course. And by around 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, we began driving. Now, we thought we were being smart, leaving early Sunday morning. But the reality was everyone else around us from our neighborhood was also leaving then. It was a huge traffic jam.
Yeah. So what 14 had been, hours, I heard it.
Yes, exactly. So about 2.5, 3 times as long as normally should have taken.
Okay. Well, I mean, as people might guess, you lost everything that you left behind in New Orleans.
Correct.
Right. So I should say that you were in New Orleans because you had an appointment at Tulane University.
My very first job.
Not to do what you're doing now,
which is
studying resilience. You were doing what?
I was supposed to be studying Japanese politics. That was my training.
Okay.
And I'd been looking at nuclear power plants in Japan, trying to understand how they interacted with communities there. So that was my book I was working on at the time. No interest in disasters whatsoever.
Right. Okay. So Hurricane Katrina happens. And as we heard, I mean, you and so many thousands of others had to get out, lost everything. It changed your life. How did you end up coming back to Boston and then changing the focus of your life's work?
So it was really obvious to me early on that my expectations of what would happen about disaster were completely wrong. So I figured the government would come in and give us a check. Maybe the Red Cross would provide us with a new house. So we actually applied to FEMA really early, like within 4 or 5 days of leaving. Our application was rejected, actually. It took us about 6.5 months to hear back from FEMA in the positive. So in the meantime,
Did they say why they rejected
it? They thought
you?
We had insurance.
We
did not have insurance. So we had sort of prove a negative that we didn't have insurance. And eventually, by March of 2006, they were on board with us. But in the meantime, of course, we didn't have a way of replacing. We didn't have insurance for those losses. And my job at Tulane was suspended. This whole school was shut down for the fall. So once neighbors and friends of ours began knowing that we were in Houston, sort of tootling around, just stunned, these phone calls began coming in, phone calls from Dallas, phone calls from California, from Pittsburgh, from New York, from Boston, people saying to us, look, come back, come to our community. We'll pay for tuition for your kids. We'll get a place for you to stay. And Brighton, we'd be living there for graduate school. We had friends here who said, look, we've got a free place for you to stay. We're going to furnish it for you. We'll get your kids in the school here locally. Come on back. And that was really the start for when it clicked in my head, you know, maybe the recovery process isn't about the government assistance, but about those networks, the friends of friends, the faith-based communities, synagogues, churches, mosques. That's really what's going to drive how things go for us as a family and as a community.
I'm speaking with Daniel Aldrich. He's co-director of the Center for Resilience Studies at Northeastern University about his own personal experience following the disaster that was Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago. Professor Aldrich was living in New Orleans at the time, and he's learned a lot about what makes communities, some communities, faster to recover than others. And as you just heard, he said it may not necessarily be how much assistance or financial assistance that community gets from the federal government. So can you tell me a little bit, more about that? Because you're talking about how one of the things that helped your family recover was these calls from friends and networks around the country to you specifically. But how does that translate into, you know, say the people who lived in the neighborhood that you were living in New Orleans? Like how does a neighborhood then recover?
So on several levels, right? First, you know, the person that saved our lives, I believe, was Kathy, our neighbor.
Yeah.
So first of all, even during the disaster, we've found in studies in Japan and elsewhere that if you have more connections, more trust, more interactions among neighbors, when the bad thing is coming, it could be a tsunami, it could be a hurricane or whatever, that warning that you get from neighbors, that's much more believed than anything from the government. No matter what the government says, local government, national government, FEMA, Red Cross, we're going to really trust our neighbors and our friends first. So if they tell us, get out, get 3 days of water, get your cell phone charged, we listen to them first. So a lot of stories I heard in New Orleans were the same. People's initial contacts with getting out were from friends and family. Then in the process of recovering, you know, where do you go next? Your house has been damaged. It's tens of thousands of dollars, even if you had insurance, which we didn't. Who pays that money? Where do you get the money from? Do you raise the money from a bank? Do you get it from friends and family? Are there churches or synagogues or mosques raising money for survivors? Like in our case, we actually got aid from a local Brighton synagogue. So those kind of networks can provide financial resources to you more quickly, I think, many times than FEMA or other organizations. And then do you want to go back? Do you feel a connection to the area? And a lot of the research that we've been doing since then have shown us when you feel that sense of place, when you feel you have friends nearby, your kids have their playmates, you have your barista you buy your coffee from, you have a certain walk you'd like to take in the park every day, that sense of belonging drives that recovery rate much better than promises from the government or anything else. Because the reality is you have to go back to someplace. Oftentimes the costs of going back are really high, financial costs, psychological costs, time costs. If you have that sense of belief, sense of belonging, that can bring you home much more quickly.
Right. So, I mean, you had only been in New Orleans for 6 weeks, so maybe you didn't have as much of those networks as lifelong residents had. I mean, have you talked to people, Kathy, your friend who first knocked on your door?
Yes, actually, for us, it's another sad story, actually. The synagogue that had helped us, in which Kathy was a member and our neighbors, never recovered. The building itself actually is now a community center in Lakeview, the neighborhood down there. And most of the members that we knew moved out of New Orleans, either to the suburbs like Metairie, which is just outside the city, or to Los Angeles, to Knoxville, Tennessee, to places in Houston. Many of them never came back. So the synagogue that we'd been going to, the community of faith we'd been part of, never really reassembled. We have been in contact with them. We've seen them. We've emailed them, talked to them. But you're right. You know, the 6 weeks we had didn't really root us in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And even if it had, even that part had been destroyed.
Yeah. So I hear what you're saying, because it makes kind of intuitive sense that social networks, a kind of social capital that you have amongst your friends and neighbors, a cohesion in the community helps a place be resilient, helps groups of people be resilient. I mean, it's kind of along the lines of it takes a village.
Right.
But doesn't this also, does this in any way sort of let the federal government off the hook? Because, you know, there's still nothing that really would replace the actual financial capital that it needs to get a community back on its feet.
At the end of the day, we need both, right? The bottom-up networks from people who live there, who feel connected, who know what's going on, and the top-down, driven by the government kind of processes, right? The government really can't know what buildings do you need rebuilt quickest? Which of the areas are the anchors for people? Is it the school, the PTA? Is there a synagogue or a church in the community that needs to be rebuilt quickest? You know, who's the leader? Who makes decisions? Who's really involved in the process? The government can't know that details because it can't get involved in all the communities around the country being facing disaster. So you need some kind of interaction, right? When the community itself is organized, they're mobilized, cohesive, and they can tell the government, look, we need this to be built first. This is much more important. A school is more important to us than some mall, right? This road's less important. We really need to have this old folks home back up and running again.
How much does the socioeconomic level of the community before the disaster matter in terms of their ability to get both the federal assistance and also the internal social assistance, for lack of a better term?
You know, I thought it would be the most important aspect. People with their own personal savings, for example, people with more expensive jobs or bigger houses and bigger cars. The reality was one of the best neighborhoods for recovery was one of the most impoverished in New Orleans, called Village de l'Est, or MQVN, the Mary Queen of Vietnam neighborhood. Mostly immigrants, a lot of them from Vietnam, many of whom didn't have even high school educations. Their overall levels of income were lower, education was lower, maybe they were second language speakers of English. They came back almost 91% within a year and a half of the process. You know, my neighbor Lakeview is still only around 80-85%. Lower Ninth Ward is around 60-65%, depending on who did you use. This community, MQVN, came back earliest because they had that cohesion.
So, and when you say came back 91%, that 91% of the residents returned?
That's right. Of the houses and businesses were reopened within a year and a half.
Okay.
It's a tremendous reopening rate. I mean, around the world, that's a sort of a world record, basically. And it's because they had a lot of things going for them. They shared a common faith. Many of them had a Catholic church they all went to. They had a common background. They had worked. Many of them had come from Vietnam, South Vietnam during the Vietnam War, settled together. They had a shared belief system that they should do things by themselves. So those factors together, those cohesion, shared language, shared beliefs, made them move well before the government got there. In fact, they had to ask the government to turn back on the power because no one else was in the city who needed it. So they were the only neighborhood getting power at a time when most of us were still wandering around our evacuation shelters.
Okay, so there have to be some lessons here for Boston. Let's just bring it right here home because, you know, of course, last winter you could largely consider as a long, slow motion disaster.
For sure.
And so how would you apply what your research from New Orleans and the like, how would you apply that research here in Boston?
Well, first of all, most of the thing about disaster in terms of, is my house waterproof enough? Do I have sandbag if it floods? Do I have food and water? Which is a great start. But the reality is it should be thinking, do I know my neighbors? Do I have a cell phone for them? Can I reach them if they're not home and I'm not home? Do I have an email to find them someplace else? Who in my neighborhood needs diabetes medicine or a wheelchair? Who has animals and pets? That kind of information is what the government will never have, right? The Red Cross won't have that. So we found, for example, in Japan, people who knew their neighbors really well could get them out of harm's way before those floodwaters came in, before the tsunami struck their community. Those communities that have those connections, they work together, they play together, they have a neighborhood bar they go to or a community library they do things together. Those kind of local social connections make it better. So I would say the first step for every Boston person should be thinking, how connected am I to my residents, to my neighbors? Like Mr. Rogers, right? Are we good neighbors?
Is that especially difficult, though, in greater Boston? Because just I'm thinking, for example, how many transient residents we have, for lack of a better term, you know, students who may not be here year-round and whose communities are pretty focused around their university life.
That's exactly why it's challenging for centers, whether it's Boston, Chicago, New York. A lot of urban centers with schools have populations that are very transient. They're in for a year. They don't care so much about joining the PTA, joining the homeowners associations. That's a big challenge, and it's exactly why we have to think about this from the social perspective first, rather than thinking, do we have enough fire trucks built in this street? Is this street strong enough for an earthquake? We need to be thinking, okay, what can we do to get students involved? How do we make sure that the local Londoners, the town and gown relationships are positive? How do we integrate communities that may have racial, ethnic, linguistic tensions? Right? That's the first stage for us as a community, to really be able to say, we know our neighbors, we can work together if there's an emergency. Some great stories from Kobe in 1995. There was a fire coming after an earthquake there. And two different communities side by side, one formed a bucket brigade and put out their own fire. The other just stood by and watched. And they asked the community, like, what happened? Why did you guys organize? And they said, look, I knew my neighbor. I trusted him. I told him, you grab the bucket. I'll grab a bucket. We all got our friends together. And they mobilized like that within about an hour. The other community hadn't worked together. They didn't have that kind of trust. That kind of bucket brigade is what we need, right? When there's snow on the ground, when there's, you know, emergency people to get through, the Boston Marathon bombings, those kind of moments we're not prepared for, right? That trust that if I ask you to help me out, please call the 911, please get a phone, you'll respond.
So I'm trying to think of a non-ridiculous way to ask this next question, but is that perhaps a little more difficult in a place like Boston, where along with, you know, this past winter where people were sort of perhaps checking in on each other to make sure they had heat, et cetera, they were also, you know, engaging in virtual fisticuffs to protect their parking spots.
Right.
I mean, I ask that seriously because, like, there's neighborliness and then there's Boston neighborliness. It's a serious question.
Right. It's a great point. And I think all over the world, right, people have that tension, right? I have my own space. I love my neighbor to a certain degree, but this is my parking space or this is my land. Don't park your car here. So, you know, during disasters, we really have to step back from our own needs and think, how do we help the elderly person nearby? Does everyone have heat? Do they need to charge a cell phone? You know, people in my neighborhood in Silver Spring, for example, would buy generators generators and share them among houses so that food wouldn't spoil, right? A big problem if the power's out for more than a few days is you lose hundreds of dollars, which could be your whole food supply at the time. So those kind of sharing moments when you have to think, okay, let's step back from my own needs, shoveling my own driveway, how about shoveling someone else's driveway as well?
Tall order.
Tall order.
But I'd like to see us be able to do that. Now, you know, what I'm hearing you say is that this is very, very much about the health of the grassroots, right, in a community, in a neighborhood, in a city. And yet Boston has appointed, Mayor Marty Walsh has appointed a chief resilience officer for the city of Boston. So how much does it matter that, you know, the city government is thinking about it? How effective can it be that city government's thinking about it if the message that you're saying is, you know, official structures don't really matter as much as the informal ones.
Well, Dr. Martin, who's our new resilience officer, she can do a fantastic amount of work telling people, look, you know, we think about disasters as the government's responsibility. If something bad goes wrong, we'll step back and they'll fix it. That's really not true. You know, in most disasters around the world, first responders are we. Whether it's an earthquake or a fire, you know, people on the ground nearby, when someone has a heart attack, when someone's stuck, gives birth on the tee, those kind of moments, it's we're the first responders. So, you know, she and other government officials can think through this and say, look, our job is to cooperate, to work together, to make sure that people have that space to find their own connections, but also we can encourage them. A lot of governments, for example, New Zealand among them, San Francisco also, they're putting money into these kinds of social ties. In San Francisco, if you have a party, up to $5,000 can come to you for having an open party, a neighbor fest, as they call it there. As long as you agree to have an open party with no, excluding no one, and have at least one booth there on things like working together, community block captains, first aid, and so forth. So there are ways to coordinate that top-down push, which got everyone's attention, with a bottom-up civil rights kind of thing.
Well, Daniel Aldrich is co-director of the Center for Resilience Studies at Northeastern University, sharing his research and ideas about how to make communities, including Boston, more resilient in the face of any kind of disaster. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Professor Aldrich. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, I'm always interested in hearing your ideas about how we can make our community more resilient. Send them to us through a comment at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll hear the story of a tiny bird, an ancient crab, and an epic journey. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.